Okay, we are at the 7:30, so I'm going to mute all. As usual, you have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a question or comment, please remute yourself afterwards. Keep background noise to a minimum. So welcome all to the, what are we, April 26th Q&A. And welcome all to anybody who is new to joining us. If you want to join, there I pasted into the chat window the address you can go to, the URL, where you can join the group. But we feel free to continue to join us as a guest. Later on this evening, the contents of the PDF of the deck that is presented, the contents of the chat window, and the audio track will be posted on our website. And I think that's all of the preamble stuff we need to go through, so I'll turn it over to Alan to go through tonight's deck.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. And we have quite a few different topics tonight, and we're going to start off with a follow-up on that Prince Spooler issue from last week, and Chris has a whole raft of information for us about that.
Yeah, now as I went down this bit of a rabbit hole, I guess, I came across a number of things that even if you don't have problems with your print spooler, you might want to pay attention because you're getting about a 5-for-1 deal on tonight's follow-up because I'm covering off some other things that maybe you didn't know you could do or have wanted to do or didn't even know you were able to do such things. So keep in touch through this, and you might find some tidbits there that will apply to you even if you're not having problems with your print spooler. So last week's Q&A, we had multiple people who talked about their printer just all of a sudden stopped functioning. And at least one case, it was fixed just by running the printer troubleshooter. And if you're in Windows 10, you can go to Settings, Update and Security, Troubleshoot, Additional Troubleshooters, Printer, run that. And apparently that can fix it in some circumstances at least. And if you're in Windows 11, you go to Settings, System, Troubleshoot, Other Troubleshooters, Printer, and do the same thing. Next. So when you're sending print data from an application to the printer, the actual sending of that print data is handled by what is known as the print spooler. And so if something is going wrong, where something is not coming out of the printer, even though you told an application to print, it could be that something is wrong with the print spooler. And it's not going to solve all your problems for sure, but it may be the problem. And the suggestion was made at last week's Q&A to stop and restart the printer spooler or the print spooler service. Next. So in order to do that, if you're in Windows 10, you right-click a blank area of the taskbar and choose Task Manager. There's a number of ways to do it. This is what I figure is the easiest. So you get Task Manager, as you see on the screen there. Next.
You've got a thing there about restarting the spooler.
Yeah, carry on. It's just I did a screenshot that was included everything. So you go, first off, you go to the Services tab across the top. Next. You scroll down long list of services until you find what is called the spooler service. Next. You right-click on where it says spooler, and you'll get a pop-up menu. And you then next, click on the restart. And that will stop and start the spooler. Or if it happened to have been stopped, it'll just start the printer spooler service. Next. If you're in Windows 11, it's similar, a little bit different. You right-click the blank area of the taskbar and choose Task Manager again. Next. Then you have your tabs across the left-hand side rather than the top, and you go to the Services tab. Next. This is a little bit easier, I find. You type in spooler in a search box. You don't have a search box in the Windows 10 Task Manager, and you type in spooler, it'll narrow down the list of dozens or many dozens of services, and you'll see spooler. Next. And then you can click spooler, next, and then there's a toolbar across the top, and you can click on restart. Now, you can also right-click on the spooler and choose from a pop-up menu to restart it, but they give you that nice tool at the top that Windows 10 didn't give you. So that's how you can do a manual stop and start of the printer spooler service, and hopefully that fixes your problems with printing. But next.
So Tom has this incredibly over-optimistic question, says, does the restart fix it forever, or is it every time?
Well, I'm presuming that people who have this problem, they don't have the problem all the time with the printer, and so they don't have to restart it all the time. What would cause it to necessarily stop, I don't know, or get hung up or something like that. I would say that it should never be required, and therefore one would hope that restart would fix it forever, yes. But seeing as it went south at least once, it could go south again. So if that's the case, then especially if it's a case where it's happening frequently, it's a bit of a pain to go into Task Manager all the time to restart the spooler. And that we will continue on in the rest of my presentation here. So next.
Yeah, I've had it happen once or twice, but it's been a long time between problems.
Yeah, so if it only happens very infrequently, it's not that hard to go into Task Manager and restart the service and see if that fixed your problem. But if it's happening frequently, you want to take another approach to it, and that's to automate it. So you can script the process, and there are three commands that are needed here, and you see them in red. So the first command is net stop spooler. So net is a command line utility that can do all kinds of stuff. Stop actually tells it to stop a service, and then spooler is the name of the process or the name of the service that you actually want to stop. Now, there is no restart command, so you can't do net restart spooler, so you have to do a net stop. The next command, let me come back to that one afterwards. The third command is the starting of it, so you do net start spooler. And so again, the net command, you start, it tells it to start a service, which is a background process that's running on your computer, and spooler is the name of that service. So the one in the middle is an interesting one. So it's a command line utility delete, DEL. Slash Q says to do it quietly, so it's not going to give you all kinds of feedback on the screen. And then what is it that you want to delete? And the first is percent system root percent. That is a system variable that points to the Windows directory. And so in most computers, that's C:\Windows, but Windows can be installed to a different location. So system root will always point to the Windows directory. And then system 32 spool printers, and then below that startup start. So what that is that's where all of the print jobs are held or put when the spooler is going to pick up from and send those jobs to the printer. So occasionally, it's not necessarily the print spooler that is sick, but it's a hung up print job that is actually stuck there in the print spooler. And so this will delete any jobs that might exist in that directory. Next. So if we want to create a batch file that can actually do this, what you do is you create a text file called, and I'm calling it restartspooler.cmd, and I'm going to paste this into the chat as well so that anybody who's interested in this, you can end up picking it up from there. And there it is. Okay, so create a text file, restartspooler.cmd. And this can be done in Notepad or any plain text editor. Next. So here's our batch file. So we do next. So the first one, echo off, tells it not to output what it is being put on the command line to the screen. And the at the start of it says, don't even echo the echo off statement. Next. Then what we do is we output to the screen just a line of text saying, stopping the print spooler. Next. Then we actually give the command, net stop spooler. Next. Then we output to the screen with the echo command, deleting all print jobs. So it just puts out on the screen the words, deleting all print jobs. Next. Then we give the command to delete all of the print jobs that happen to exist on the system that might be hung up there. Next. Echo dot gives you a blank line. So echo is a way of sending out to the screen a string of characters. If you do an echo followed immediately by a period, it'll just give you a blank line. Next. Then we output to the screen the words starting the print spooler. Next. Then we do a net start spooler, which is the command to start up the spooler service. Next. and then we pause for 5 seconds. I want to give credit to Jocelyn Douard for he actually gave this at a Q&A a while ago, and I based this script on his script, a little bit different, but basically following the same tactic. Next. So only the red lines are strictly required. The other ones are just going to pretty up the way things appear on screen. Next. So if we actually want to run this, so to run a batch file in File Explorer, you right-click on the file in File Explorer, and then you select Run as Administrator. The reason why you can't just double-click on it is if you double-click on it, you'll run it in the security context of your normal account, which is not running as an administrator, unless you're running as the actual administrator account, which I don't think anybody is. So in order to have any services stop and start, you have to be as an administrator, and so that's why you right-click on it, and you choose Run as Administrator. Next. Okay, so here's the output from the screen. So this, you'll get this black box appear on the screen, and the first line says stopping the print spooler, because we said echo stopping the print spooler. Number two, it actually, when you do the netstop spooler, it actually outputs two lines of text to the screen. So it outputs the print spooler service is stopping, and the print spooler service has stopped or was stopped successfully. Next, and then number three, we end up with the echo deleting all print jobs. So it puts out the text of deleting all print jobs. And then because the DEL was done with /Q, we have no output from that delete command to the screen. And then we have a blank line with the echo dot. And then we have the line of text saying starting the print spooler. And then followed by that, we have the actual command. Net start spooler is given, and it outputs two text lines. So it outputs the line, print spooler service is starting, and the print spooler service was started successfully, hopefully. And then lastly, we have timeout 5, and what it does is it just counts down on the screen, waiting for 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and so forth. And you can press any key if you just want to have it go. But basically the idea behind that timeout 5 is just so that you can see on screen that things stopped successfully and they restarted successfully. And you had no error messages on screen. Next. So the next thing we want to do is probably create a shortcut to the batch file. And the reason for that is that you may have this command file, who knows where. It could be in your documents folder. It could be in a utilities folder or whatever. But you don't want to have to go hunting for this batch file when you actually need to run it. So the best way to do it is just right-click on it, drag it out to the desktop, and then drop it there. And then you'll get a pop-up menu because you right-click dragged, and you can choose create a shortcut here. Next. Okay, so as I said, the command file is going to run as a regular user account rather than an administrator. So you want that shortcut to actually run the batch file as an administrator. Next. So you can right-click on the shortcut that is existing on your desktop and choose properties. Next. And then click on advanced. Next. And then there's a checkbox for run as administrator. Now, one of the reasons why I told you about the idea of you're getting a bonus of about 5 for 1 here, if you ever have a program that actually requires you to run as an administrator, this is the way that you can have a shortcut to that program, just automatically do it. So you just go into the properties, choose the advanced, click run as administrator, click on OK, and from then on, that program will actually run as an administrator. Next. And then optionally, you can change an icon. A lot of people probably don't know that any shortcut they have on their system, they can easily change the icon to something else. So why not give the shortcut to this a better looking icon? Next. So we right click on the restart spooler shortcut. We choose the properties. And then we click change icon. And then you can actually point to anything that contains icons. And I would suggest that you try out this one and they look for icons in this file, enter in percent system root percent or C colon backslash windows backslash system 32 backslash image res dot DLL. It's a program that can, that has hundreds of icons within it. So you do that and then you just scroll through that to find a likely looking icon, which next. It happens to have a bunch of printer icons in it. Next. And then click OK. Next. And then on your desktop, rather than this generic icon, you now have this restart spooler shortcut, which has a nice printer icon, which will remind you what that's all about. The last thing you might want to do is, if you need this really frequently, you might want to pin it to the taskbar. Okay, so this is useful because taskbar is almost always visible, unless you've got it set to auto-hide, whereas the desktop isn't always visible. It's often covered up by program windows. So it turns out that you cannot pin a batch file to the taskbar. If you try and drag a batch file or a shortcut to a batch file to the taskbar, you'll get the circle with a line through it saying you can't do that. Well, there is a workaround for that. Next. So right-click the shortcut for the restart spooler and choose properties. Next. And then what you have to do is change this so that rather than it just calling the script, you go to the start of the target line and you put in CMD space slash C and have a space after that. What this does is it changes the shortcut so that it's not just the batch file, but it's actually the command processor that is going to actually run this anyways. So you're just telling it run the command processor, CMD, and then the slash C says to actually run the script that is following this on this line. Next. You click on OK. Next. And then you can drag the shortcut to the taskbar. And next, you'll end up with an icon on your taskbar that is the shortcut. So lots of little bits and pieces in there. The first part of stopping and starting the spooler from Task Manager is the essential thing. Everything beyond that is things that if you have to do this very often, just might make it a little bit easier for you. And then other people might get ideas on, well, I can now pin other scripts to my taskbar. I can change the icons for my shortcuts and other things that I might find useful that I just thought I'd throw in. And that's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Tristan has posted a link in the chat window. If anybody prefers using PowerShell, there's a link to the equivalent commands for the PowerShell version of that script.
Good stuff.
If you can't pin a batch file to the taskbar, could you pin a shortcut?
No. No. It sees it as a script, and you can't pin scripts to the even though it's a shortcut, it still sees that it's a script. And it won't let you pin it. But by changing it to that where you're running CMD followed by the script name, it allows you to print it because CMD is a program.
Stuart says this could be called hitting windows with a hammer to make it do what you want.
Yeah,
I think that's a little unfair. I mean, remember, this print spooler isn't supposed to fail, so you shouldn't really have to do this.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. I think you're a bit optimistic, Chris, when you said you don't think anybody's running Windows as a administrator. I suspect a lot of people are.
I don't think so. Most people are standard. They are an administrator, but when they're running as a standard user. And that's why you get the elevated prompts coming up saying that, oh, do you want to make this change? It's because it's changing your security context to administrator at that point in time.
Why don't take a vote and see what people are doing?
I just find it odd because I have an Excel macro that runs SQL. And to do that, you have to be running Excel as an administrator. Now, I'm running as a regular user, so I have to use the right click trick.
Yep.
But a couple of my colleagues are running Windows as an administrator, and they can just run Excel directly.
Yeah, it depends on the level of what it is you're actually trying to do. Yes, you're right. But in terms of stopping and starting services, absolutely, you have to do as run as administrator, even if your account is an administrator account. It doesn't prompt you for, oh, do you want to make this change to your computer or anything like that?
Okay, thanks, Chris. Lots of good information there. I'm sure people will be checking that out. Okay, next up we have a follow-up from Bob Walker. This is left over from last week. Sorry, Bob, we didn't have time to get to you last week. But
yeah, just a second, Bob. I'll have to make you a co-host.
And it comes from when the ice storm hit and all the power went off all over the place. So Bob has put together a package here on various kinds of backup systems.
Okay, let me just share my screen here. Okay, and okay, so I started this out right after the ice storm we had a few weeks ago to just update some previous information I'd given on backup power sources, and it ended up being a lot more, a lot of information in here on what to do during a failure or after a failure. Some of this information is not directly related to computers and other topics normally covered by OPCUG, but for those that have had long power outages in a recent ice storm, you may find it helpful in future events and just day to day. We'll cover not just some backup power technology, but some of the other power outage things you may want to cover as you prepare and cope with a power failure and clean up afterwards. So in September 2021, I did a couple of presentations on backup power sources, and this included inverters. The inverters take DC power most often, 12 volts, and turn it into AC power, usually 110 volts. Consumer models range in size from about 100 watts capacity, and some of these plug directly into your cars or vehicles' 12-volt socket, or what they used to call a cigarette lighter socket, to over 5,000 watts that connect directly to large 12-volt batteries. Now, many inverters output the power as square wave AC, and this is okay for heating devices like toasters or whatever, lights, some motors, or for plugging in power supplies for laptops and other devices, but it may not be suitable to directly power sensitive electronics, things like your desktop computer or your TVs. And the more expensive inverters can put out what they call full sine wave power. And this is what you get from the plug in the wall from the power company. Or they at least have modified sine wave, which is sometimes called triangle wave. And this may or may not be suitable for some of your devices. Large inverters should be powered by deep cycle batteries that can be almost fully discharged without damage, instead of regular car batteries, because if you almost fully discharge a regular car battery, it can damage it. Any batteries used for inverters should be topped up every few months. And for lead acid batteries, it's preferable to use a smart or intelligent charger that senses the type of battery and the battery's condition, and that have a repair mode that uses slow pulse reconditioner to reduce battery sulfation and acid stratification in the lead acid batteries. These can safely charge a dead or near dead battery because it starts to charge up with a very weak voltage and current and gradually builds it up, as opposed to just hitting it immediately with full voltage and current. And these can maintain a full charge without overcharging the battery. You can get cheap trickle chargers that can overcharge and damage the battery. Deep cycle batteries are available at Total Battery, Canadian Tire, and several other places. The chargers are available at Total Battery, Amazon, Canadian Tire, and elsewhere. And the charger capacities range from 1 amp to whatever you want to pay for. And the prices start at about $60. If you're charging car or deep cycle batteries, you'll want 5 to 10 amps capacity, because if you use a 1-amp charger, it can take days. Uninterruptible power supplies, talked about this a few weeks ago. UPSs contain their own surge suppressor, inverter, and battery, and so this is all automatic inside the device. And most UPSs put out full sine wave AC. Now, some of the cheap ones don't, so you should check this out in the specs of any UPS you're considering buying to verify this. The lifespan of the UPS batteries is typically 2 to 6 years, depending largely on the number of discharge and recharge cycles it goes through. So if you're in a frequent power outage area, the batteries won't last quite as long. You should test the battery condition at least once a year or so by unplugging the UPS from the wall outlet with all your devices running. If the UPS doesn't power them for as long as you expect it to, it's time to replace the batteries. Now, UPS manufacturers, CyberPower, APC, and some other manufacturers sell their original equipment, their replacement batteries, directly or through their dealers. And third-party batteries are also available, including replacements for batteries that the UPS manufacturer no longer supplies. The third-party batteries are available over the counter at Total Battery. And you should bring in the old battery to make sure you get the proper replacement part. Or you can buy them online from several sources, including Amazon. Another solution during a power failure is what are referred to as power stations or power packs. These rechargeable portable power stations and power packs can fill your light-duty needs. Like run some LED lights, charge your smartphone. Larger capacity ones can power a coffee maker and do some other things. Depending on the make and model, they can be charged with by USB, which is 5 volts DC, 12 volt DC, like a car battery or a power supply, or 120 volts AC. And depending on the model, they'll output USB 12 volts or 100 DC or 120 volts AC. And some of the larger models will even boost start a car with a dead battery. Some come with their own solar panels or can make use of any 5 volt DC and or 12 volt DC solar panels to charge them up. Now, if you're buying the solar panels from another manufacturer, make sure the specs, for example, the voltage for the solar power and the power station match. These power stations are available from Total Battery, Canadian Tire, Amazon, and other places, starting at about $150, and go up in price from there depending on the capacity and output. Lightning is a problem that can not only cause power outages, but a close-by lightning hit on the grid can get into your house wiring. So it's a good idea to unplug your uninterruptible power supplies, any surge protectors, and any other expensive equipment like your home theater stuff and desktop computers. From the wall during a thunderstorm. It's also a good idea to disconnect any outside antennas or dishes during a thunderstorm. You can get coaxial cable quick connects that make this a lot easier, and you can get these at Amazon and some electronic stores. A lightning strike that gets into the device from the antenna or dish, I originally said can, but it will travel through the device that's plugged into the antenna or dish, like your satellite receiver. and it'll get into your home wiring and causing a lot of damage. Just quickly, the Quick Connects, you disconnect the coax connector from the device, connect it into the one end of the Quick Connect, then the other end just slides onto the original coaxial socket. Okay, maintaining standby equipment, a big thing is batteries. Rechargeable batteries will self-discharge over time. Rechargeable batteries used for power supply or for standby power should be topped up every few months. And you can set up a schedule for doing this, like using the first week of January, April, July, and October to do all your routine maintenance work. And this includes not just charging the batteries, it can be changing your furnace filter or other things. When charging lead acid batteries, which includes most car and deep cycle batteries, you should do it in a well ventilated space. Even sealed lead acid batteries can give off some explosive vapors during charging. So you want a well ventilated space to do this in. You should avoid alkaline batteries in any equipment that they will be sitting in for a long time. They tend to leak and cause damage over the course of time, even the premium ones like Duracells and Eveready's. You can use lithium batteries instead. They're more expensive, but they last a lot longer, and they don't leak. If you get these cheap batteries that come with some of your stuff, use them to make sure the stuff works and all that, but don't leave them in the device because they're the most likely to leak on you. Okay, maintaining backup equipment, gas-powered. Now, I originally wrote this just for generators that you only use occasionally and all that, but it also applies to anything with small engines like your lawnmowers, snowblowers, etc. So I threw information in as well for them. Small engines normally do not like ethanol into gasoline. Modern car and truck engines are made for ethanol, but ethanol in many small engines can damage gas lines, gaskets, etc., and the ethanol can retain water moisture. And this is an enemy of any internal combustion engine. Most premium gasoline is ethanol-free. You should also use premium fuel stabilizer, and this is stabilizers that are two-year rated instead of six-month rated, and sometimes the only difference is how much stabilizer you put into the gas. You should use the stabilizer for all the gasoline for your small engines. At the end of the season, put the equipment away with less than a quarter tank of gas and top it up with fresh gas at the start of the next season. So when you put your lawnmowers away in the fall or put your snowblowers, don't top it up with gas first. Also at the end of the season, or after a long use like your generator, you can change your oil, the filters, spark plugs, and do any other regular maintenance before putting the equipment away. Okay, if you have used oil in the crankcase, used oil can be slightly corrosive, so it's best to put it away with fresh oil. Maintaining gas-powered equipment, for equipment like generators that does not get used regularly, 2 to 4 times a year, you should put a bit of fresh gas in it and run it for 50 minutes or so to exercise it. Circulate the oil around and whatever. When you're finished, you can drain most of the gas out until you run it again. There's a device I bought from Amazon called the Ontel Turbo Pump. It's a little battery-operated liquid transfer pump that you can drain the gas out of the – stick it in the filler opening for the gas tank. and put the end of the hose into your gas can and turn the switch on and it drains the gas. You're often advised when putting gas equipment away for the season to drain all the gas and to run the engine until all of the gas in the fuel line and carburetor is used up. However, when the film of gas in the carburetor that's left in the carburetor evaporates, it can leave a residue that causes a float needle to stick. And then when you gas it up again, all of a sudden you got gas leaking out of the carburetor. If you have fuel stabilizer in your gas, you don't need to drain the gas completely. Just leave it in. If you have a two-cycle equipment, like chainsaws and weed whackers that require to mix oil in the gas, you can get cans of 50-to-1 fuel oil mix at Home Depot and other stores. This stuff has fuel stabilizers already in it, so it is fresh for up to 2 years after you open it and 5 years if you don't. Battery-powered. Most gas equipment can be replaced with battery-powered equipment. And the battery-powered stuff comes in 18-volt to 56-volt models. And this eliminates most of your routine maintenance requirements with gas engines, like changing the oil, changing the spark plugs, et cetera, et cetera. Some 18-volt equipment, for example, chainsaws, weed whackers, and leaf blowers, is suitable for occasional or light-duty use. But if you're going to use such things for heavy-duty or frequent use, you might want to, or for something larger like lawnmowers, you'll want to consider a 48 to 56-volt equipment. Now, some manufacturers have a whole family of tools and equipment that use the same batteries and chargers. For example, Ryobi, which you can get at Home Depot or Amazon, has a huge assortment of power tools and yard equipment that uses their family of 18-volt batteries and chargers. And they also have, Ryobi also has a family of yard equipment that uses their 58 or 48-volt batteries and chargers. Ego, which is available at Rona, Lowe's, Amazon, you might see it advertised on TV as well, has a 56-volt family of yard tools that include riding and zero-turn lawnmowers and snowblowers. And these use the same family of 56-volt batteries and chargers. Now, in most of these tool families, you can buy a kit with one or more tools, a battery, and a charger. Or you can buy the tools, batteries, and chargers separately. The kits are a cheaper option, especially if you're just getting started. And note that if you buy 48 and 56-volt batteries separately, they can be eye-wateringly expensive to buy on their own, especially the larger capacity batteries. For example, it's $650 for a 10-amp-hour 56-volt battery. And these are required for the the riding lawnmowers, and the lawnmower takes four of these. So you want to buy the lawnmower with the batteries already in it. That's a lot cheaper. Okay, I'm going to give a shout out here for Total Battery. They have all sorts of batteries, including watch batteries, car, boat, and deep cycle batteries. They have the sometimes hard to find alarm system gel cells. So if you have a home alarm system that has one of these gel cell batteries, guaranteed they'll have it. Take the old battery in and make sure you get the right one. They have all sorts of AAA, AA, CD, 9-volt batteries and alkaline or lithium. And just about any other battery you could possibly need, like your UPS replacement batteries. They also sell battery-related products like chargers, power packs, cases, etc. And they'll recycle most used batteries and pay you a core fee for used car and deep cycle batteries. Now, three times I've driven up to the store in a car where the battery is just about at the end of its life, opened up the hood, taken the battery out, traded it in, put the new battery in, closed the hood, and drove away. So it's a really good place for, and you can usually get the car batteries cheaper than Canadian Tire. They have three Ottawa area locations, and I pictures there of the outside and the inside of the Nepean one. Now, when you do get a power failure, here are the outage websites and their phone hotlines. Hydro One, which services rural Ottawa and most of rural Ontario, has their outage hotline and website. Hydro Ottawa, which serves urban Ottawa, has their own, and then Hydro Quebec has their own. Now, some of the information between Ottawa Hydro and Hydro One is available on each other's websites, but not the full amount. During a power failure, the ice storm we had, a lot of power lines are down, and for safety, stay at least 10 meters away from the down power lines. Last year, after the derecho, I went up through Stinsville, which is very badly hit, and they had power lines down all over the place, and people in nearby homes had sort of taped it off or put a bunch of stuff along so you didn't actually accidentally drive across them. Another safety issue during a power failure is carbon monoxide. You want to be careful about that. If the power is out so your source of heat isn't working, do not bring your barbecue indoors for heat. They give off a lot of carbon monoxide, and during the ice storm here, lots of stories about people being rushed to the hospital with carbon monoxide poisoning for doing this. Even if it's raining or snowing, it's best not to run a generator inside an attached garage, even with the door open, because some of the carbon monoxide may get into the house through various cracks and openings. You should have a working carbon monoxide detector in the house if you're using a catalytic heater in the house for emergency heat, or all the time if you have an oil or a gas furnace. My next door neighbor, when I was in North Door, the burner box or whatever in the their oil furnace rusted out, and the family got carbon monoxide poisoning as a result of that. And if you have an attached garage especially, you should have a working carbon monoxide detector in the garage. Now, there's a picture here of an improvised rain shelter for a generator after the May 2022 derecho storm. This is courtesy of Bob Harris, one of our members. I thought it was a pretty ingenious idea to keep the rain off the generator, and it kept it outside. For related information, there's the previous presentations on uninterruptible power supplies, surge protectors, solar charging for your smartphone and other devices, and solar charging to other backup power sources. And in a future session, we'll cover recycling all your old batteries, stuff like your steel gas or your used oil. For example, you run your generator for a while, you got to change the oil. What do you do with the old oil? How to recycle your old electronics, your printer ink cartridges, compact fluorescent bulbs, etc. And in another future session, we'll cover the care and feeding, the dangers, and the disposal of the lithium batteries that power so many of our modern devices, from our smartphones and laptops all the way up to electric vehicles. And that's it for tonight. Let me stop the share here. And
the question, Bob, or rather a comment, Tim suggesting if you go away on vacation, it's a good idea to disconnect important electrical devices.
Yeah, that's an excellent suggestion. Oh, another thing in the previous presentation on standby power, I also covered whole house generators as well, and I had a couple of friends that have those. You see them advertised on TV a lot, and they can be quite helpful. And
okay, thanks a lot. So moving along, we've got a follow-up on VPNs from Chris.
Yeah, so a question came up about VPNs at the last Q&A on how much having a VPN might affect the speed of your connection on the Internet. And I, quite frankly, didn't really know the answer to it, so I decided to do some testing on it and see if I could come up with some answers. So I tested using, for VPN, I used Tunnel Bear VPN. And for the testing of my speed, I used speed test from Ookla for most of the tests. I also did some tests using Cira's internet performance website. I figure it's probably the most trustworthy, but it had some issues, and I'll talk a little bit about why I didn't use it for all of my testing. Next, and I just kind of paste in those URLs into the chat. Question, Cira.ca, the URL on that, I obviously didn't cut and paste it from my browser. It's performance.cira.ca, an extra C in there. Sorry about that. So next. Oh, sorry. If we look at how our traffic flows with a VPN, so if I was using Cira Internet Performance Test, what would happen is I'm here in Ottawa and I'm connecting, for example, to a VPN server in Rome because I want to do bypassing of geolocation restrictions. And say the Cira server is actually in Vancouver because Cira has no servers outside of Canada for doing their testing. So next. So my computer makes an encrypted traffic connection to the computer in Rome, which is the VPN server in Rome. Next. The traffic gets decrypted and sent over the open internet to the Cira server in Vancouver. Next. Traffic goes back from the Cira server in Vancouver to the VPN server in Rome. Next. And then it gets encrypted and sent back to my computer in Ottawa. So remember, VPN only encrypts your traffic between your computer and the VPN server. It has to be unencrypted in the rest of its travels. So next. So let's see what if we're using speed test. So again, my computer's on Ottawa, the VPN server is from Rome, and the speed test server, in this case, is going to be in Rome. They have servers all around the world. So next. So again, it's encrypted, goes to the VPN server in Rome. Next. Then it does a short hop, decrypted to the server, to the speed test server in Rome. Next. Does a short hop back to the VPN server in Rome. Next. And then it gets encrypted and sent back to my computer in Ottawa. Next. So the long and short in this is that I used speed test for most of the serving because it minimized long hops. And so I thought it was likely to have fewer variables in the speed that were going to be coming into play. So next. So I did a bunch of tests here. And so for upload speeds with no VPN, I did a bunch of tests. And you can see I connected through Ottawa Rogers. I went to Kingston. I went to Ithaca and so forth. The thing you'll see here is that I could only test with using the speed test with things that were within a couple hundred kilometers of Ottawa. So wherever my access point is going to a speed test server, they only offer up servers that are relatively close to you, which sort of makes sense when you're trying to measure, you know, what the speed is. You want to introduce as few variables as possible, such as long hops. So my average upload speed was 16.3 megabits per second. Next. When I did a test with the VPN, and again, this when I was going to different countries and so forth, I was hitting different speed test servers, but they were in the target country. So if I was connecting in France to a VPN server, I was connecting to a speed test server in France as well. So as little as possible variable being introduced in there. My average upload speed was pretty close to the same thing, 15.21 that should be megabits per second. So not all that much a degradation. But on download, with no VPN, again, I could only select speed test servers within a couple hundred kilometers of Ottawa, and the average download speed was 674 megabits per second. Next. And then with the VPN, again, the speed test server was within the target country, and the average download speed was dramatically slower, 342 megabits per second. So I had a big hit on performance going to on my download speed, whereas I didn't have a big hit on the upload speed. Next. So the upload speeds largely not impacted without the VPN. Average of 16.3, and with a VPN, 6.7% slower. So not an awful lot of an impact there. Next. But on the download speeds, it was significantly impacted. So I ended up with a 49% slower connection when I was doing downloads. Next. Now, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't understand why there should be an asymmetric performance difference on this. A VPN, it doesn't know the difference between a download and an upload. I mean, it's just traffic. And so to me, it just didn't make a lot of sense. And I wondered if it's perhaps due to the fact that I'm getting pretty high speeds on download, 674 megabits per second versus 16.3 megabits per second on the upload. And I wonder if somebody somewhere along the line was throttling me because I was just sending too much traffic through, so they slow things down a little bit or something like that. I'm guessing. I've reached out to the folks at Tunnel Bear, and I've yet to hear back from them on where they think that asymmetric speed performance difference would actually come from. Next. So I did reach out on some general issues and a number of other specific issues. So I asked, about what is their advice on slow network performance from people at Tunnel Bear. They came back and they said that while it seems like it might be a simple matter, it really isn't. It has a lot of things to consider. So you can have bandwidth limits, latency are the foundation of where you'll see issues. The server distance can have a big impact on it. The speed of your own network can have a big impact. And the protocol that you're actually using can have an impact on it as well. Next. So some of the issues that they thought were things that the average person can actually do to try to improve performance. And this goes with some of them are very specific to VPN, but most of them are actually general things that can apply even if you're not using a VPN. So you could try resetting the Windows firewall because it could have an impact on it. And the instructions are there. You go to Control Panel, Windows Firewall, restore the defaults, and check to see if your issues have gone away. Next. You could try switching the VPN protocol. So this is if you are using a VPN. So in Tunnel Bear, you run the Tunnel Bear app. You make sure that it is turned off. You go to, in the Tunnel Bear app, you go to Settings, Connections, VPN Protocol, and it normally should be set to auto, where it'll negotiate what is the best protocol to use, but you can actually try switching to a specific protocol, and they have WireGuard, OpenVPN, or IKEA V2. And so then, reconnect using Tunnel Bear and see if your slow behavior has gone away. And if the problem is still there, they suggest switch it back to auto because that really is typically the best setting to have. Next. You can reset the DNS cache. So DNS is the domain name service. And so sometimes you can get issues with the DNS cache getting either corrupted or too full, and it takes too long for it to go through and trying to determine what is the IP address for something that you're trying to connect to. So for that, you run a command prompt as administrator. You type in ipconfig slash flush DNS, and it'll flush the DNS cache. No danger to that. It'll just reestablish those DNS connections afterwards. Next. Make sure you aren't using any proxy server that might be interfering with it. So again, connect, use command prompt as the administrator. Type in netsh winhttp reset proxy, and then see if that helps you on your problem. Next. If the problem is still there, you might want to update your network drivers. So right-click on the Start menu, choose Device Manager. In the left-hand panel, you expand out the area for network adapters, and it'll show you one or more network adapters. Right-click each of the adapters that you see and choose the option to update drivers. On the screen that follows that, choose the option to search automatically for drivers. And then there is one adapter in there if you are a TunnelBear user for VPN. You can try disabling and re-enabling the TunnelBear adapter that you'll see underneath the network adapters. Next. So I'd like to say thanks a lot to the folks at TunnelBear. They gave me a free week of unlimited VPN because I very quickly ran out of my monthly two gigabytes that you get for free. It is a nice service that I highly recommend that people try out. If they are using or thinking about VPN, try it out. You get 2 gigabytes a month for free, which for a lot of people, that may even be enough for everything that you need. It is not enough for speed testing around the world. Thanks for answering all my questions when I wanted nitty-gritty details. They were very friendly, very helpful. Thanks for providing the advice on how to troubleshoot generically network performance problems, and for just being very easy to talk to a bunch of people. So that was my testing that I finished up with the VPN.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. We have there's two or three items in the pipeline here. I don't think any of them are time critical, so I'm going to postpone them until next week.
Sure.
And see if anybody has any other questions. Bob Walker's still there. There are some questions for you, Bob. One of the questions was, do you need to top up lithium ion batteries?
You should, top the batteries up to whatever the recommended limit is. And I think we discussed this a little bit a week or two ago, that some devices now, laptops and smartphones, you can set in a mode where the batteries will only charge up to about 85 or 86% and never actually top it up. So you have to look at the recommendations of the manufacturer of the equipment or the manufacturer of the battery. But we'll talk a bit more about lithium ion batteries in a few weeks, because there are several issues with them that can be a problem.
Okay, next question was, if you have a surge protector that has a switch, is it sufficient to just switch it off before a thunderstorm, or should you actually unplug it from the wall?
You should actually unplug it from the wall. The switch can be shorted out by a lightning strike, no problem at all.
Okay, well, if you're going to cover lithium-ion batteries, Bob, you might want to check the chat, because there's a bunch of questions and comments and things.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah. Okay, and the other one was, can you talk more about power bars? Do they work in on and off mode?
The surge protectors are in the power bars. I think I mentioned it when I did a presentation on surge protectors, but the cheap power bars that say they have a surge protector in them, you get what you pay for. and the surge protector is after the power switch. So if the power switch gets shorted out by a lightning strike, too bad, so sad. I had a lightning strike on the grid near me a few years ago that also took out my phone, but it killed the TV that wasn't turned on, and it killed the control board for my garage door opener. So
yeah, oops.
All sorts of things can happen. Just a note on what Chris was saying about VPNs. I've used two of them, NordVPN and Avast VPN, and I haven't had any noticeable speed problems with either one. But when we started doing the Zoom meetings, I kept on getting this pop-up saying your internet connection is not stable, and sometimes it would drop out entirely. And so I started turning the VPN off before the meeting. And I don't usually have that problem at all unless we're in really, really bad weather.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, we hit the magic witching hour. I don't see any other questions that don't relate to batteries and power supplies in the chat. So to wrap up, let's just talk a little bit about our next club meeting, the May meeting, May the 10th. It's going to be members' favorites, and we're still looking for a presentation. So if you have anything that's computer-related that you'd like to share with the group, and if you can put together a few-minute presentation on that particular topic, we'd like to hear from you. But before May the 10th is May the 3rd, which is next Wednesday, which will obviously be our next question and answer session. So yeah, if we haven't answered your questions tonight, or if you have new questions, or if you have topics that you want to share, get in touch with us at suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we'll sign you up. So that's it from me for tonight. I hope everybody enjoyed it, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. See you next week.